My guest today is a scientist who achieved prominence in the field of human fertility. He was made a life peer in 1995 and is Professor of Science and Society at Imperial College London. He's a familiar face on television too, having presented groundbreaking series like The Human Body and Child of Our Time, and he's an author as well. He is Professor Robert Winston. Whom might such a man choose as his great life? A famous scientist, a doctor from history perhaps? Lord Winston, whom have you chosen? Who was he? And why have you chosen him?
Well, I've chosen Michel de Montaigne because this is a man who is a humanist above all. He understands the human condition. He is born in 1533 and he writes these most extraordinary essays, which are as modern now, I think, in many ways, as anything written currently. And he's funny, he's witty. He understands happiness, sadness, all sorts of human emotions and human experience. And his book, his essays, can be dipped into or read in their entirety. Beautiful thing is that they are wildly entertaining, just for brief bursts as well as at length. But he's a remarkably modern individual.
Give us an example, just a sample of his writing. Writing here, I think, in this piece that I think you have about his own writing.
Yes, well, he says of his own writing in his preface to his essays, and therefore, reader, I myself am the subject of my book. It is not reasonable that you should employ your leisure on a topic so frivolous and so vain. Therefore, farewell. There's something absolutely endearing about that. He is a kind of Shandian figure at that moment. You know, he never sticks to the subject. He writes an essay about something, but he moves to a topic that really interests him, which is implied by his writing. And he does that constantly and in a way that's extraordinarily entertaining. And somehow very modern, too.
With me to help unravel the life of this influential writer of the French Renaissance is Sarah Bakewell, whom I suspect must feel as though she knows Montaigne very well, having spent 5 years working on a biography of the man that's called How to Live, A Life of Montaigne in One Question and 20 Attempts at an Answer. Sarah, knowing him as you must, I wonder if you can imagine what it would have been like to have met him.
Yes, I often found myself thinking that as I was working on the book. I think that he would be a very charming dinner party guest, as long as you didn't indulge in too much small talk, because he himself said that if he was at a formal dinner where there was just a lot of small talk about nothing, he would actually go into a bit of a dream world because his mind would sort of wander off, and so much so that if somebody suddenly asked him a question, he'd give a completely stupid answer, not worthy of a child, he said, because he was so distracted, he hadn't really been paying attention. So he was perhaps a little bit dreamy, I think you might find him, but as soon as you got him onto a subject that interested him, he would be absolutely marvellous company, always perhaps putting some fresh angle on the things that you were talking about or perhaps questioning you. But also, he actually very much enjoyed, he said, just the repartee amongst good friends where you're exchanging jokes and...
Was he a listener?
Oh, yes, he loved to listen. He said that he much preferred listening to talking. And he especially liked to listen to people who had some particular field of expertise and would talk about that. So whether it be shoeing horses or building boats or...
Or human fertility, Robert. I imagine he'd be fascinated.
Well, he has quite a lot of medical opinions, of course. Mm. And, of course, he is extraordinarily human about medicine. He's very human about doctors, too. He doesn't really trust them, I think, with good reason. I mean, he is pretty clear that doctors are no more certain than anybody else. And he's also aware of the uncertainty of science, actually, which, of course, comes into some of the philosophical writing where he's getting more serious about how little we understand. Que sais-je? I mean, what do I know is the motto that he uses. And he is very much questioning certainty, I think, which is one of the most attractive things about him.
I want to return to this in just a moment, but just to get back to the beginnings, he came from a noble lineage. He had no money worries. To describe his childhood.
Well, his grandfather was made a lot of money in the market, really, as a seller. And then his father inherited a huge fortune. They bought this chateau. And his father was obviously a very cultivated individual. By the way, I should say that this is in Bordeaux. You know, it's a winemaking area. Mm. He's very much involved with the wine trade. Montaigne is spoken to in Latin.
And good Lord.
So he becomes more fluent in Latin than any other language. I mean, far more than French, for example. And indeed, even the servants are forbidden to speak to him in French. In fact, his father, Pierre, only employs people who are good in Latin. And, of course, this actually is one of the things, it's a bit like Tristram Shandy, it sort of marks him out for life. He then, of course, becomes, you know, if you like, a Latin scholar. So throughout his writing, his work, perhaps more than any other person of the time, I guess, is absolutely peppered with the most remarkable classical quotations.
This is extraordinary, isn't it, even in his age? This wasn't normal
yes.
with children.
His father, it was himself a fascinating character because he came up with this really unprecedented idea of... It was an interesting mixture because he sent the boy away to a peasant family in the neighbourhood. Instead of having a wet nurse brought in to the chateau, he had Montaigne sent out so that he would learn the ways of ordinary people. Then he was brought back to the chateau and spoken to only in Latin, as you say. And not only did Montaigne's father, his own Latin was a little rusty. He had to brush up on it. His mother had to learn Latin because if she wanted to speak to her own son, she had to do it in Latin, and the servants. And I really think it's that combination of having been sent out to live amongst ordinary people, so getting a great sense of himself as being very ordinary. But at the same time, he was growing up with the ancient writers, philosophers, poets, historians. The language that they used was his native language. And he grew up with them as his neighbours, really. In some ways, he was closer to them than he was to his own family because they spoke the same language.
And it shows in how he writes about people, doesn't it? Because he talks about people he meets in the field or, you know, on a horseback or wherever it might be, ordinary people, and he puts their predicament together, interspersing that, of course, with the most remarkable and quite gory anecdotes about classical times where people committed terrible acts of murder or suicide or whatever it might be, and he's not reticent to be quite blunt about, you know, how they might have died.
At six, he's packed off to boarding school in Bordeaux. Any idea, Robert, whether he enjoyed his boyhood days, whether he enjoyed...
It would be difficult to imagine that he didn't. I mean, there's no real suggestion, I think, in what he writes that he didn't enjoy his childhood. I think I think this is essentially quite a happy man. He writes about happiness quite a lot, and he has some really interesting insights into happiness. I mean, one of the things which I'd like to quote later on, if you'll allow me, is that I think he kind of argues that you can't really be happy unless you've understood what it is to be unhappy.
Let's hear it now.
Well, I mean, it's a long story, but essentially, you know, one of the things that really worried him was that he might be afflicted with the bladder stone. And the bladder stone produces about the worst pain that man can bear, and it was not uncommon in those days, and he knew that his father had bladder stone in his 50s, and he assumed that it was genetic. You know, he'd thought about, you know, they thought that possibly genealogy might have something to do with it. And lo and behold, on the very day that when his father got bladder stone in his time, he got bladder stone at the same age. Well, he describes this in his essay on experience, which is perhaps one of the favourite essays that most people have, if they have a favourite one. And he says, "The fear and pity felt by people for this illness give you something to glory about. You may have purged your judgment and cured your reason of such glorifying, but those who love you still recognize some stain of it within your complexion. There's pleasure in them hearing saying about you, there's fortitude for you." And he goes on to say, "They see you sweating under the strain, turning pale, flushing, trembling, sicking up everything, including blood, suffering curious spasms and convulsions, sometimes shedding huge tears from your eyes, excreting frightening kinds of urine, thick and black, or finding that they are attained by some sharp stone, bristling with spikes, which cruelly jab into the neck of your prick and skin it bare." And then he says elsewhere, "I thank fortune for having sent me the stone, because when I am pain-free, I understand what it is to be truly free of pain." And there is this notion that unless you've been in the depths, and there's no question he's been in the depths, and I think that he feels that that has really, in a way, informed his life. But he's not depressed by it. You know, some people, when they have a very adverse experience, get depressed. On the contrary, he sees this as something which is enlightening.
Before he begins writing down these thoughts, Sarah, he has a spell as a magistrate in Bordeaux, am I right?
Yes, after he finished school, he went off to study law. We don't actually know very much about that period of his life, but he must have studied law at some point. And then he worked for 13 years as a magistrate in Bordeaux, which was a job that involved politics, but it also involved preparing law cases to be sent on to the judges. So he spent a lot of time assessing cases, often quite maybe trivial cases brought by one person against another over financial matters, and he'd have to summarise both sides of that argument in order to present this summary to the next level. That was his first job at the court of Bordeaux, and I think from that he got a great sense of how to see and represent all sides of a question.
To weigh an argument.
To weigh an argument.
To see it from two different
directions.
To see
everybody's perspective on it, and also just a sense of the immense fallibility of human life. And I think, touching again on this question of the bladder stone and the way in which pain and illness actually made him almost appreciate life more, I think a part of that also comes from his general feeling that one is happier in a somewhat imperfect condition. Because if we expect everything to be perfect, then life is going to fall short of that and we're going to lament that we haven't got what we want. He also writes about getting older as well as suffering illness, that if you adjust to a less than perfect state of affairs, it actually releases an enormous pressure off you and it allows you to enjoy what you do have. And again, it's about putting things in perspective. It's about not expecting life on earth to be heaven, but just the messy, ordinary, flawed, imprecise, imperfect business that life actually is. And I think we can learn more from Montaigne in that than we can in almost anything else.
Is it at this point, Robert Winston, while he's still a magistrate and before he's begun writing his essays, that he makes the closest friend that he'll ever have in his life, Étienne de la Boétie?
Yes, and of course there's a tragedy here, because of course this is the person who, when he dies, when he finally is deceased, he misses more than anybody, and he writes about this loss. And that also, I think, illuminates his life and his value for life. That, I think, and his own experience of being charged from behind on a horse, I mean, probably by mistake, by one of his servants. Maybe the horse was out of control and he falls to the ground and he's unconscious and he's carried back to the chateau. And it's not quite there where he's going to live. I mean, he may have had some kind of subdural, who knows, well, he might have had quite a serious injury. But I think those two events inform him in a way and make him extraordinarily human.
Not so long after the accident in which he nearly died, he makes a decision which changes the course of his life. He has the following inscribed on the bookshelves of the library in the tower of his chateau, which is to be his workroom in retreat for much of the next decade. Let me read it. In the year of Christ, 1571, at the age of 38, on the last day of February, and this incident is slightly more pompous than Montaigne's later style became, his birthday, Michel de Montaigne, long weary of the servitude of the court and of public employment, while still entire, retired to the bosom of the learned virgins, by which he means the muses, I think, where, in calm and freedom from all cares, he will spend what little remains of his life, now more than half run out. If the fates permit, he will complete this abode, this sweet ancestral retreat, and he has consecrated it to his freedom, tranquillity, and leisure. And he goes on, Sarah, to create the work for which he's best known, the essays, or essay, but it's plural. It's worth explaining that essays didn't exist before he invented them, did they?
No, he was very much an admirer of Plutarch, who had written Moralia, which are in effect essays, but they're nowhere near as personal. The thing that was so extraordinary about Montaigne's innovation was that he wrote about his own life, the details of his life, his own experience, things he'd seen, things that had just gone through his head, things that had come up in conversation, little bits and pieces from his reading. And he wrote about his feelings, and we were talking about the riding accident where he was knocked unconscious, and he wrote about the feeling of being semi-conscious and not being sure where he was and feeling in a dreamlike state in a way that nobody had written about before. Possibly St. Augustine had written in a very personal way about his spiritual experiences, but nobody had written about just feeling a bit woozy, which is what he was writing about. So he really began a genre. He certainly began the genre of the essay in the modern sense and the personal essay in the modern sense. And he began a very modern sensibility, I think.
The idea of the examined life.
Yes, of the examined life, but not only to a higher moral purpose, but also just for the fun of examining it. Today we're so used to writing about ourselves in this very personal, very revealing way. We blog and we do social networks and we write about ourselves, we talk about ourselves, we kind of share details of our own personal lives all the time. We kind of take it for granted that that's something that people do, but in Montaigne's time, in the 16th century, it was still really taboo to write about yourself so revealingly, unless you were a great person who was perhaps recording your impressions of court life or the details of a particular battle.
Read something, just a snatch, that means a lot to you, Robert.
It is an absolute perfection and virtually divine to know how to enjoy our being rightfully. We seek other conditions because we do not understand the use of our own, and go outside of ourselves because we do not know what it is like on the inside. Yet there is no use our mounting on stilts, for on stilts we must still walk on our own legs. And on the loftiest throne in the world, we are still sitting only on our own rump.
Where did he write this sort of stuff? Describe the tower in which he wrote, Sarah. You've been there, haven't you?
I have, yes. I was lucky to go out of season when there was nobody else there except us. I was able to spend a couple of hours there just looking at the view that he would have looked at. It's in beautiful countryside because this is about 30 miles from Bordeaux. Wonderful wine-growing landscape. The chateau had a sort of square construction, and he adapted a tower which was already there at one corner of this complex. It's circular. It's not particularly tall. It's three floors tall. And he had a little chapel on the ground floor, his bedroom where he would very often sleep on the next floor up, and then his library on the next floor up from that. And in the library, he had circular shelves made because to fit the circular tower with all his favourite books on them. He had a collection of about 1,000 books, which was quite a good one for the time. And there he would write and he would read and he would look out of the window where he could actually keep an eye on what was going on in the courtyard, which is what he was supposed to be doing because he was supposed to be the seigneur of the chateau and keeping a close eye on everything. But he really didn't enjoy doing that very much at all compared to thinking, reflecting, talking, meeting people. He wasn't really much of a one for sitting at a desk or sitting on his chair and reading. He liked to stroll up and down, so he would walk around, I think, his circular library quite a lot. But he also very often did his thinking outside, so he loved to go out walking, riding, and of course, travelling. He did quite a bit of travelling in his life.
Montaigne's been enduringly popular in France. Any educated Frenchman knows about Montaigne, less so on this side of the channel. How did his work project itself into the prominence that it's enjoyed for four centuries now in France?
Well, I think it's the absolutely never-ending modernity of Montaigne that attracts readers generation after generation. And in fact, one of the things that's interesting when you look back on the 400 years that people, over 400 years that people have been reading Montaigne, that each generation tends to find Montaigne as being modern, one of their own. So you get the romantics leaping on Montaigne and saying, he's just like one of us. And then the Victorians.
And so he's influenced a lot of writers after him, too. I mean, he's clearly influenced people like Descartes, for example, and he's influenced William Shakespeare.
Yes, very much so. And also generations of personal essays, particularly in English.
And of course, his stories, his anecdotes, which are sometimes hilarious. I mean, you know, this isn't somebody who's, you know, very solemn. I mean, this is somebody who's actually quite funny and very witty.
But how did the work actually get into circulation? How did people, a wider public, discover his work?
Well, when the first edition came out, which was in 1580, it was really quite a small publisher, but it was a word-of-mouth runaway success.
Yeah. And went viral.
It did, absolutely. And that was without him sort of twittering or, you know, blogging about it. It caught on very much amongst the gentlemen and gentlewomen, actually, of the France of his time, who read it for pure pleasure, but they also read it for its classical quotations, for its wisdom was what they were looking for. But it sold so well that just a few years after publication, one of the major bibliographers of the day was talking of it as being right up there with Seneca and Socrates.
I mean, you mentioned something very important, Sarah, which is that he definitely writes for women as well as men. And that in itself is quite interesting, I think, after all, for somebody writing in the early 16th century. And, of course, that seemed very clearly in the longest essay, Raymond Sebond, which, of course, is written actually largely for a woman reader, to examine what faith actually means. But it goes far beyond that, because he brings in all sorts of other human things which have nothing to do with religion at all, which makes it a totally fascinating essay, and one that at first seems a bit difficult because everybody's forgotten who this Catalan theologian was, who was probably also a medic, but nobody really remembers him. In fact, if you go, as I have done, go to the Encyclopaedia Britannica, he's not even got an entry in the encyclopaedia. Well, of course, Montaigne's entry is quite lengthy.
Mm-hmm. Sarah calls her book on Montaigne, How to Live. Do you think that Montaigne himself believed that he was writing a useful manual on how to live? What do you think,
That's
Robert,
really
he thought he was writing?
Yes, is he writing a manual on how to live? That's a really interesting question. Why do people write? He's obviously writing to be read. He's not writing purely for himself, but I think there's probably a dual purpose. Part of it actually is just exploring himself. I think there's undoubtedly that's actually happening. But I think it goes beyond that. I think he's connecting through time with what it means to be a human being. And I think he hopes that other people will learn as he's done from what he's written.
If you were to write a series of essays through your life of the kind that Montaigne wrote, for all I know, you're privately doing it, Robert Winston, would it be like Montaigne's work?
Gosh, I mean, I'm afraid I'm much more arrogant than he is and have so many more imperfections than he has. I did try writing essays when I was in my early 20s, mostly about plays that I saw or read, and I used to read or see two or three plays a week at one time, and similarly with films, I would go pretty often, and I would tend to keep a diary of that, and very regrettably I stopped doing that. But of course, I mean, I never considered for a moment that I could write completely off a tangent in the way that he does. His essays don't always turn in a full circle like modern essays tend to. I mean, he often leaves you on a completely different point from where you started. So his essays don't have, if you like, quite the same formal structure that a piece in a newspaper would generally have.
Yes, you know. I find that reading him as a journalist or as a columnist, it strikes me that actually we're much more formalised now in the way that we write. His was free form. It was stream of consciousness. You couldn't get away with that these days. You have to have a beginning, a middle, a conclusion.
I think he'd be spiked by editors on the grounds that this is impossible.
Yes.
Not that it's impossible to read, but
where
it's just,
is this going?
Yes, where's it going?
What is your argument, as John Hurt used to say?
I think that's right. And in a way, perhaps that's why I like Tristram Shandy so much. Because, of course, you know, when books digress in the way that Montaigne does, you learn so much more.
Perhaps if Montaigne had ever written an autobiography, it could have been called But I Digress.
Yes.
Yes.
It's actually, incidentally, I just throw in one of my favourite book titles ever is Arnold Bennett's collection of essays, I don't know if you know them, which is just called Things That Have Interested Me. And there's another one, Things That Have Interested Me, second series. And I just, how lovely to have the luxury of being able to call a book something like that, because really that's what it's all about. You know, that is what personal essays are about, and that's what a lot of the best writing about.
Publishers don't publish many essays nowadays, do they? I don't know whether people don't write them.
Well, of course, there's blogging, and I think there's, you know, this is where quite a lot of that kind of writing now is going. It's going onto the internet, and it's got that free-form nature. It's got that constant adaptability, responding to things that happen, throwing in new ideas as they come up, and new links. I mean, you could almost see some of Montaigne's classical quotations in the essays as being kind of like hyperlinks, as you would get in a blog entry, where you can follow that.
He died in 1592 of kidney stone complications. He was 59. Presumably, Robert, I realise you're not a GP, but this is the sort of condition that could have been treated quite easily today.
Well, it would be treated easily, but he probably died of renal failure, I imagine, because if you have constant infection, which he did have, and he describes the infections in the urine, that would affect the kidneys, which would eventually pack up. Yeah, I mean, 59 is young, but of course you get this sense throughout the essays from about the age of 33, 34 onwards, that he's already thinking of age in a very different way from how he would now. I mean, nowadays 59 seems immensely young, but that was probably a fairly full measure and older than most people would die, of course.
A tough question here, Robert. Did Montaigne really live the life that he urged others to live? Do you think a man could we all live as he suggests? Is there a manual for living there?
Yes.
Was it a great life, or was he just a good essayist?
No, this is more than just a good essayist. This is somebody who's not pretending. This is somebody who's actually living the good life. And he's prepared to learn and rethink. He says, for example, one of the essays, he was hardly ever beaten as a child, and he wouldn't expect people now to beat children or his children. So, I mean, I think that, on the whole, he tended to try to modify what he did from what he learnt as he went along.
Is there any one piece of advice in all his work which, looking back over your own life so far, you either wish you had heeded or did heed to your advantage?
I once heard a very well-known musician say to a masterclass that there are two kinds of teachers, those who are still learning and those who've learnt everything. And he said, learn your music from somebody who's still learning. And to my mind, that's exactly what Montaigne is about. I believe in doing things where you're still learning. And if you're not still learning, it's probably not worth doing them.
My thanks to Professor Robert Winston, who's championed the life of Michel de Montaigne, and to our expert witness, his biographer, Sarah Bakewell. Goodbye.